Drivers find, deliver, install.
This is WMNF in Tampa. Eve Prang-Plues is not able to make today's show, so we're going to hear a previous program from Health and Nutrition with Eve Prang-Plues. Well, good morning. Welcome to the Health and Nutrition Program with Eve Prang-Plues. Eve has made it safely into the studio after a harrowing drive up I-75 from Sarasota. Hi, Eve. Nice to see you.
Thank you.
So you had some people on your bumper behind you driving up?
They're the only ones.
Did they know you do a radio show?
They're the only ones.
Did they know that your safety is important to the rest of us?
They're the only ones that are important. It's all about me. I'm going to go 90 miles an hour and you're in my way. You know, it's...
Well, I'm glad you made it safely. You know, you should have a sign on your car saying health and nutrition expert on board or something.
I think if I put a sign on my car, it might be just a little stronger than that.
So any advice to people who tailgate at 80 miles an hour?
Make your will. Make your five wishes declaration for your hospital visit. You know, hope you don't take anybody else out with you.
It's all these people in these big SUVs and big pickup trucks.
Oh, but a lot of times it's the USF students. It's the, you know, the
late for class?
Yeah, I mean, they're just barreling along in their little Civics or whatever they are, you know, these little mini cars, and they're just blasting away and putting on their mascara and talking on the phone and driving 90 miles an hour all at the same time. And then when they go by you, it shows all of their USF stickers on there.
Oh, okay.
Trying to get to class.
Okay, well, I'm glad you're here safe.
Me too.
So we're going to talk about health and nutrition today. We're going to take some phone calls, as we always do, and we're going to take some emails. The earliest questions almost always get answered. The later ones are sometimes harder to answer because usually by the time it gets to 10:50 a.m., the phones are popping and
they're smoking.
Email inbox is filled with questions that people have. But here's our email address if you want to ask a question of Eve. Our address is dj@wmnf.org. You can also call us at 813-239-9663. Frank Knox is our phone producer today. So, Eve, what's on your mind? What have you been thinking about?
Well, I've been worried about all the people that think juice is health food. Not just the, you know, juices that you're buying at the fancy organic stores that you pay 10 bucks a glass for, but people feeding their kids juice, thinking that it's a better idea than just giving them water. And with almost 20% of the children in America now obese, you know, 40% of adults, we're in a situation where we have to look at these sugary beverages, and people don't think of a 12-ounce glass of orange juice as being equivalent to a 12-ounce can of soda pop, but they both contain 10 teaspoons of sugar. And when you separate the fiber from the sugar, you know, when you've got the fiber, when you eat an orange, you're getting that sugar in little time-released envelopes, you know, those little tiny bits that are in the orange or in the apple or in whatever the fruit is. Allow that sugar to go into the system very slowly and provide fiber. And fiber's not just benign. Fiber does create really beneficial things happening in the gut. But when we take the juice and separate it from the fiber, you're getting the blast of all that sugar at one time. And so I doubt seriously if I handed you a multivitamin that had, you know, 10 teaspoons of sugar in a day's supply that you'd want to take it. And yet people somehow think juice is good for them. And so the nature of the juices, I'm talking specifically about fruit juice that has the high sugar, but even the vegetable juices, you know, a lot of people are, they're definitely into this, oh, they're going to buy this 3-day juice fast, you know, from somebody that's going to provide these jars of juice for them, and then that's going to detoxify them. They don't understand the nature of what detoxification means. And when you juice green vegetables and vegetables in general as separate from fruit, if they're not organic, you're actually concentrating the pesticides, herbicides, fungicides that are going to be present in there. You know, I've had 3 clients so far that have virtually shut down their thyroid glands as a result of doing a big bunch of kale every day. Kale has a compound in it called an isothiocyanate, You knew that. Everybody knows about isothiocyanates.
I can spell it too, yeah.
And it is a suppressor for the thyroid. And these are people that thought, well, kale is so good for you, I could take an entire bunch of it and juice it. And the entire bunch only makes a couple of ounces of juice, but it really concentrates that particular compound. And so here's somebody who thinks they're doing their body a real big favor, and they're not. Now, we don't have the sugar issue with the vegetable juices like we have with the fruit juices, but we have these other items. Like pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, isothiocyanates, etc.
Well, this time of year, a lot of people are drinking smoothies, and there's two kinds of smoothies: one heavy with added sugar, and the other's made from just fruits and vegetables, and maybe protein powder. I don't know how.
Everyone, a million varieties.
Yeah, there's a million varieties. So, what do you think of smoothies?
We are designed to chew our food. When we chew, we actually signal the brain that we've eaten. We don't do as much of that when we're drinking liquids. We don't register those calories in the same way. But the fundamental thing is for people to understand that we need to stop giving these juices to kids thinking that we're doing them a favor. You know, if you're going to give juice to a child, give them 2 ounces of it, you know, or put a splash of juice in some water. But what we've discovered now is that the babies and toddlers that have grown up drinking juice, and on average, they're drinking 10 ounces a day, which is twice what the American Pediatric Group thinks that
it's
they should have.
It's almost a can of soda.
Yeah,
almost.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That what happens is those kids grow up to be the soda drinkers because they're used to that sweet palate. You know, breast milk is sweet. It's 3 times sweeter than cow's milk. And so we grow up with this idea that sweetness is the very first taste we develop. We don't develop the taste buds and the responses for bitters and pungent foods until later in our life. And that's in part to keep the kids as they were toddling along behind you, you know, walking through the jungle, the forest, the bush, from grabbing a leaf and putting it in their mouth because it was bitter. And so the nature of cultivating that sweet taste is what we want to avoid in terms of giving little kids juice. You know, if I have somebody that is a performance athlete, normal weight performance athlete, and they want to use juice as part of the ways to get those, you know, one of the most important of the electrolytes, the potassium, back into their system, I'm going to have little argument with that. But with all these sports drinks that are out there and all these pep-up drinks, these things that contain caffeine, I see people walking out of the convenience stores sometime with half a dozen of these, you know, supercharged kind of drinks. They don't understand the damage that they're doing to their body. And so I just caution people that juice is not health food. And when we're doing these, you know, 3-day juice fasts, et cetera, and all sorts of claims are being made about them, there are certain juices that are especially valuable for certain organs. Pears help gallbladders, and cabbage juice helps ulcers. You know, there are certain specific things, but it needs to be under the direction of a professional. Not just wailing down a great big old glass of carrot juice in a granola bar and calling it lunch.
And what do you think of juice fasts?
Again, detoxification is a very nutrient-dense process. We need a lot of not just vitamins and minerals, but also aminos to do the conjugation that the liver has to do to get toxins out of the body. It isn't just a matter of the fact that I'm not eating or I'm doing the worst of them, a water fast. But juice fasting can really be trouble. And people get this grandiose idea that they're doing this thing that's really cleansing their body. And what that means is they don't understand that detoxification is a multi-step process that takes place in the liver, where we, just like we use the word conjugate in English, where we change a word into another form, we conjugate molecules. And in conjugating those molecules, one example, we have to have a lot of sulfur. You know, sulfur's high in eggs and asparagus and all the members of the cabbage family. Sulfation is one of the pathways. And if you don't eat foods that have these sulfur compounds in them, you can't sulfate these particular toxins. Therefore, you can't get them out of the body. So I think there's a very naive chemical understanding of what detoxification means when people are doing things like juice fasting.
Eve Prang-Plues is here. We're talking about health and nutrition. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address, dj@wmnf.org. Can I ask? Go ahead.
I want to add a postscript to that. My my greatest focus in making this announcement about juice is saying it's a whole lot easier to prevent obesity than it is to treat it. And when I look at the children, you know, yesterday I was out and about, and I look at the children that are 7 years old, 4 years old, 9 years old, and they already got their belly hanging over their pants. Don't give them any juice.
813-239-9663. I want to ask you about MSG because I've been reading a lot of articles about MSG, monosodium glutamate, and how it may not be as dangerous as we've thought for 30 years, at least my friends have thought, and that there may be some anti-Asian or anti-Chinese bias in our dislike of MSG. Some people say that it causes headaches, sweating, flushing, numbness of the face and neck, palpitations, nausea, chest pains. Other people say, and articles have been written about this, that, you know, okay, if that's true, then how come the Chinese don't have this?
Well, first off, when Chinese cook food, they put one pinch of MSG in a dish that's going to serve a family of six. You know, we're not talking about taking that container of accent and sprinkling it on things. It's totally overblown. You know, anybody who comes into my office who says, oh, I can't eat at a Chinese restaurant because, you know, they use so much MSG. And if I go into a Chinese restaurant and they've got a sign on the table, no added MSG, my first question is, can you eat a tomato? Can you eat a mushroom? Do you ever drink grape juice? Do you ever have broccoli? Do you ever have peas? All of those things are loaded with MSG. And plus, MSG comes under so many different names on the label. You don't always know that MSG is there. But glutamate. Glutamate is the preeminent neurotransmitter in the brain. So you have two kinds of neurotransmitters in the brain. You've got excitatory and inhibitory. As I've called them before, gas pedals and brake pedals. Glutamate is a preeminent gas pedal. And so the nature of neuroexcitability, MSG could create a little bit of excitability in the brain, just in the same way that caffeine does. But since it's in walnuts, since it's in soy sauce, since it's in Parmesan cheese, you know, when somebody says, oh, I have this MSG sensitivity, you know, I ask them those questions. Oh, yeah, I eat all of those foods. Well, duh, then it ain't the MSG. There are individuals who are incredibly sensitive, and most of them are B6 deficient. If we run a serum B6, a blood test for B6, their B6 is in the basement. And so a very... Even an average multivitamin, multimineral is going to have B6, pyridoxine hydrochloride, in it at 50 milligrams. And so if you got B6, you can metabolize MSG without any problem. I think it's been overblown for years. There's a lot of ingredients that are way more important in terms of avoidance than MSG.
And if I go to a restaurant other than an Asian restaurant, am I likely to be exposed from restaurant food to MSG?
Oh, well, do you ever go to Chick-fil-A and get a sandwich? Do you ever have a Dorito? You know, it's in so many, every beer, you know, every loaf of bread. MSG occurs naturally in gluten. It occurs naturally in casein, the primary protein in dairy products. So by the time you've had a pizza that's got the cheese, the tomato, the mushroom, you know, et cetera, and the gluten in the dough, you've gotten 50 times more MSG than you're ever going to get at a meal at a Chinese restaurant.
Very interesting to know. Well, you're listening to WMNF 88.5 FM. This is the Health and Nutrition Program. The first question comes from Billy. He says, Eve, if my cardiologist is right, the cell phone tower 200 meters from my house is making me tired all the time. Besides moving, do you have any suggestions?
Yeah, get another cardiologist. I have no denial of the fact that the electromagnetic spectrum has an effect on some individuals. The nature of this soup of electromagnetic energies that we all live in, from cell towers and from lots of other sources, I can't individuate that the cell tower alone is going to be what the cause of fatigue is without looking at primary causes of fatigue. You know, fatigue is one of the preeminent problems that people bring to me in practice. And the first thing I have to do is find out, are they anemic? Let's run a CBC. Let's run a complete blood count. Let's make sure that they're not anemic. Okay, we've checked that off. That isn't the cause of their fatigue. All right, are they getting enough sleep? Are they sleeping 7 hours or more a night? Absolute sleep, not just being in the bed, not just, you know, watching TV propped up on your pillow, but lights out, asleep at night? Have they gotten adequate sleep to deal with their fatigue? Then the next question I'm going to ask is going to be about things like their thyroid. We're going to run a TSH test, a thyroid stimulating hormone, and make sure that that thyroid stimulating hormone number is under 3. And okay, so that's another piece of the fatigue puzzle. Then we're going to look at cortisol. Cortisol is one of the most important of the hormones that your adrenal glands make. We also know adrenaline. And so cortisol, we measure 4 saliva samples in one day, 8, noon, 5, and 10 at night, and actually graph the cortisol because it should be highest in the morning when we wake up because we are designed to wake up and hunt. And so you needed to be really alert to go out there and catch your food for the day. And then cortisol falls gently as the day goes on so that by the time it gets at night, we're ready to fall into restful sleep. So when you're looking at fatigue, if you're not looking at anemia, if you're not looking at thyroid, if you're not looking at sleep, if you're not looking at cortisol, and if you're not looking at the dietary factors, people that have fatigue need to eat protein within an hour of arising. You know, are they living on bagels and Pop-Tarts? So you have to look at all of those things for fatigue before you start looking at cell towers. So I don't deny that things can be affected by the new instruments that have been put in to track your electrical use. I don't deny that the cell phone next to your bed, the fan over your bed, the radio that you've got your alarm set on that's right behind your head on your bedboard, all of those things are EM fields and can affect the way that our body responds. But I'm not going to put it at the top of my list.
Let's go to the phones, and we're going to go to Sahila from Valrico. Sahila, is that you?
I called you before I even heard what topic you were speaking of, so, but it sounds like you're jumping around, so I guess it's okay to bring another topic in, and that is, what are your feelings about the latest research that saturated fat may not be as dangerous to your health as we've been told for so many years?
Well, we have to have some saturated fat in order to maintain our cell membrane. So the saturated fat that occurs naturally in the food, we know that there's a limit to what the body will tolerate. And so, like, if somebody's eating four-legged animals, because I don't call them white meat and red meat, because red meat is salmon and white meat is pork, but I do as the Native Americans do and call them two legs and four legs. If you're eating four-legged animals, you want to eat things that have the word loin or round in the name, top round, bottom round, sirloin, tenderloin. Those are the things that have the lowest amount of sat fats. The nature of skim milk and 1% milk, I've never endorsed because we have to have those fats in order to transport things like vitamin D. But the real problem are the trans fats. They're the ones where we take a polyunsaturated oil like soybean oil and we hydrogenate it. We run high pressure hydrogen through it and we partially saturate it and we turn it into a molecule that doesn't look like anything that occurs in nature, or very little of it occurs in nature. And so we have to remember a fundamental law of chemistry is if you change the shape of a molecule, you change the function of a molecule. So when we're getting these trans fats in baked goods and restaurant foods, I just read an article this weekend about a guy who kept a McDonald's cheeseburger for 6 years and it looks perfectly able to be eaten. It's like, but it's like that coffee cake that I kept, you know, for 36 months. Actually 40 months I kept that coffee cake. It never went bad. Why didn't it go bad? Because it doesn't have any food in it. Yeah. You know, it's got these trans fats in it.
Have they passed the law saying that all the trans fats have to come out of the food?
Down to 0.5 grams, down to, you know, a half a gram of it. You know, if it's under a half a gram, they don't have to list it. So if you're still eating a lot of processed foods, you can still get trans fats in the foods. Okay. But you're absolutely right. Sat fat is the enemy in volume.
Okay,
it's the volume of it.
So you wouldn't recommend meats every day, but maybe once a week?
But the meats may be fine every day. It depends on volume. You know, when we're looking at 14 lunches and dinners, my general recommendation to people, and of course this has to be individualized, is that at least 4 of those 14 meals should be fishes. And we're not talking just seafood. We're talking fishes specifically. 4 of those meals are two-legged animals, birds, chicken, turkey, duck, pigeon. I say that because that's what they fed me in Egypt. Four of them should be vegetarian meals. They should be a bean-based meal. Yesterday, I had a black bean and quinoa burger for lunch. So four bean-based meals, four fish-based meals, four bird-based meals. That leaves two meals a week for you to have four-legged animals if you choose to eat them. So of the 14 lunches and dinners, that's one of the ways that I balance it. But, you know, if you look at the palm of your hand, if you look at the palm of your hand in size and thickness, you should never eat a piece of meat bigger than that at a single serving because you don't have the enzymes to digest it.
Yeah.
But there are some people, you know, they just think they got to get their beef in every single day. Well, what is the volume? That's really the issue.
Yeah.
And the gnarly fats that we get from deep fat frying. You know, the deep fat frying, what happens when you keep those oils up at 400 degrees for 10 hours and then turn off that deep fat fryer and turn it back on the next day for another 10 hours? Those gnarly compounds are doing way the heck more damage than the sat fats are doing.
Mm.
Is that helping?
Yes, very much.
Okay, Sahila, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
And you're listening to WMNF. Logan writes this, my vitamin D test results came back as 29.5. How do I raise it to 65 as you suggest? How long will it take and how will I know I reached 65? Thanks for being there, writes Logan.
Well, the only way you'll know that you reach 65 is if you get it tested again, but you're below the bottom end of the margin. The test is 30 to 100, so the mean, the halfway between 30 and 100 is 65. I always want everybody over 50. I mean, women who have a vitamin D level above 50 have half the rate of breast cancer of women who have a vitamin D level below 50. But my recommendation would be 5,000 IUs of vitamin D3 a day, and take 5,000 IUs of vitamin D3 a day for the next 3 months, all of July, August, September, and then in sometime in October, test it again and see how far that's brought it up. Vitamin D can only be absorbed in the presence of fats, and so you want to make sure that you take it with a meal that's got some fats in it, not just, you know, a snack of celery sticks or something. And I don't know how well you're going to absorb the vitamin D. I don't know about the rest of your diet. I have a vitamin D receptor defect in one of my genes, so I don't take up vitamin D the same way that everybody else does. So, you know, I don't know if you have a VDR gene that's a little wonky like I have. So I can't tell you it's going to take 1 month, 5 months, 10 months. Don't really know, but my recommendation would be 5,000 IUs a day for 90 days, retest, and see how far it got you.
Let's go to Amanda, who's calling from St. Petersburg. Hi, Amanda. You're on the air with Eve Prang Plews.
Hi, thank you. We were talking yesterday about water fasting and how it can be addictive and people get high off of it. Can you talk about the chemistry in that and how that can be detrimental?
Water softening can get you high?
No, water fasting.
Water fasting.
Oh, I'm sorry. all of a sudden I'm thinking, boy, I missed that trend completely. You know, you have to define what it means for somebody to get high. I mean, it may be nothing more than a hypoglycemic episode that they're having as a result. I never, ever, ever recommend water fasting. Under any conditions, you actually will increase the toxicity burden in the body with water fasting. So go further with your question.
So Amanda, do you know people who water fast and do they get a kind of high on the power that they're exerting over their body?
Yes. We were just talking about it yesterday. Whatever addiction that makes them feel lighter, freer, ability to just be able to be more clear-minded. I don't know if it's more psychological than over the biochemistry.
Personally, I think it's very psychological. I think it has to do with the fact that you have aligned yourself with a belief and you're giving yourself a whole lot of credit for that belief. But, you know, I want to stand on a science platform. I want to make sure when I'm reporting stuff, whether it comes from the research or if it comes from folklore, that it stands on a science platform, that it's scientifically relevant. And the nature of water fasting is we actually see an increase of toxins. Remember, toxins are stored in different locations in your body. We store a good bit of our toxins in our fat. Mm-hmm. We store certain toxins like heavy metals like lead in our bones. We store certain toxins like the heavy metal cadmium in our kidneys. We have, the body has preferential stash places to put various toxins. Well, when you do water fasting, your body has to have a certain amount of aminos just to keep the whole machine going. You have to make all of your enzymes, you have to make all your hormones, and you have to make all your neurotransmitters. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Those things are all proteins. They're all made with aminos. So if I don't have any aminos coming in the dietary selection, then the body has to steal those aminos from somewhere. And the way it's going to steal those aminos, it's going to cannibalize the muscle. It's going to break the muscle down to give the aminos in order to make the neurotransmitters, hormones, and enzymes. So that's where it becomes catabolic. The body starts breaking down muscle. Well, duh, where's the toxin? The toxin's in the fat.
Yeah.
We're not breaking down the fat first. We wish we could break down the fat first, but that isn't what happens. Fat is really messy to burn. Try to set fire to a stick of butter. You know, have a frying pan fire. You'll see how messy burning fat is. Light a match to a piece of paper. You'll see how clean it burns. Carbohydrates burn way cleaner than fats ever did. So the body is not going to try to access fats to burn them initially on something like a one-day water fast. Ain't going to happen.
But if you're releasing the toxin, then are you flushing them out by drinking more water?
You don't flush.
Water?
The body's okay, not a toilet.
All right.
The body, the toxin goes to the liver, and the liver uses 57 different enzymes. They're called P450, cytochrome P450 enzymes, and they all have numbers, P450 1B1, P450 C19. And each one of those enzymes attaches to a different toxin. So the toxin that you're going to get from the pesticide and the toxin you're going to get from the diesel fume are going to have different P450 enzymes. They're going to hook onto them. Then once you've hooked on that enzyme, then you conjugate. Then you actually change the molecule from a non-water-soluble molecule into a water-soluble molecule. Because if it's a non-water-soluble molecule, your kidney doesn't even recognize it. Your kidney doesn't even see it. So it doesn't know it's supposed to pee it away. When we convert that molecule into a water-soluble molecule, now the kidney can go, okay, you out of here. And we pee it away. 85% or more of our toxins go out the stream of urine. About 15% go through the bile and into the feces. Very little comes out through the skin. Very little comes out through the lung.
All right. So you're saying, though, that if you don't, this process doesn't get rid of toxins, though, by drinking a lot of water.
No.
Okay.
No.
Mm-hmm.
And,
like,
you know, people say, oh, I'm going to flush my kidneys. They're not a toilet. They're a filter. But they can only filter what the liver has presented to them. The liver has to do the detoxification process and present that that molecule to the kidney for the kidney to decide to get rid of it.
So how do you make more toxins go through the liver? If that's your intention, if that's the intention of water fasting, what's a better way to do it?
To have a nutrient-dense program.
Carbohydrate.
Well, no, not just carbohydrates, but, you know, we need proteins in there, too. We need aminos in order to do that.
Mm.
So the circumstances are get the blinking toxins out of the diet. Stop eating processed foods.
Mm-hmm.
You know, stop using chemicals in your house. Stop putting chemicals on your skin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Los Angeles has just figured out that 40% of all their air pollution now is not coming from cars. 40% of all their air pollution is coming from personal care products. Your deodorant, your hairspray, your moisturizer, all of those things are creating more volatiles in the air than the car exhausts are. Isn't that a mind blower?
Yeah, I think we just lost Amanda. Amanda, thanks a lot. Thanks for the question.
And thanks for the laugh, Amanda. I really do appreciate it.
Well, I think...
I meant the laugh about the water softening getting you high. I just thought that was a riot.
Lisa writes this. A few weeks ago, Eve was discussing eggs and said that the egg should not be cooked hard. Why is that?
Well, I didn't say you couldn't cook a hard-boiled egg. I just said that you're going to get more bioavailability of the phosphatidylcholine in an egg that still, the yolk still moves. In other words, a poached egg, a soft scrambled egg, a soft boiled egg, you know, an over easy egg. You know, by the time you leave the egg in the fry pan too long, you turn it into a frisbee. You know, it essentially becomes rubberized. And so you're not going to break that down as easily. So somebody who has heartburn or somebody who has incomplete digestion, they're not going to do really well with a hard boiled egg, but they might do well with a poached egg. So there's nothing wrong with cooking it hard. It's just not, you're not going to access as much of the phosphatidylcholine. And phosphatidylcholine is one of the fats that you desperately need for the sheaths of the nerves and for your brain.
Eve Prang Plues is here. She does the health and nutrition program every other Monday here at 10 a.m. on WMNF. So tell your friends around the country that she's on the air and they can tune in at WMNF.org. And Anonymous writes this, what do you think of the keto diet and those drinks that they're pushing that put people into ketosis?
Let's use the word pushing. I think the keto diet is a critical diet for people who have seizures. I think the keto diet may work for people to get them to jumpstart to lose a few pounds and encourage them to make some lifestyle changes. But the problem that happens with every diet is you go on the diet, and then that means you come off the diet. And so if you go right back to the same habits that created your need to do the diet in the first place, guess what? You're just going to cycle through. So I don't care whether it's the keto diet or only eat green food on Thursday diet or the, you know, human growth hormone diet or yabba dabba doo diet. Doesn't make any difference. What I see is if people don't make a lifestyle change, they're not going to get the benefits.
Not going to work. Okay, let's go to Rita in Tampa. Rita, you're on with Eve. What's your question? Hi, Rita.
Hello?
You're on
hi.
With Eve.
Oh, hi, Eve.
Hi, Rita.
I have a question. My father has peripheral neuropathy of his hand. And we've tried oils, we've tried CBD, we've tried a lot of different remedies, and nothing is helping. So is it a hopeless case?
First off, does your father have diabetes?
No.
And has your father ever received chemotherapy?
No.
Does he have any neuropathy in his feet at all?
Neuropathy in the feet? No.
No neuropathy in the feet?
Mainly the hands, and they're always freezing, and, you know, he just has, like, the shingles. You know, I think he got it when he had the shingles about 6 years ago.
Okay, and is it every finger in the whole hand, or is it zoned on the hand, where it's like the pinky and the ring finger, but not as much on the index and the middle finger?
Is it every finger? Yes, every finger and the thumbs, yes.
And does it end right at the wrist, or does it come up the arm at all?
Does it end at the wrist? Yes. It doesn't go up the arm.
Okay. First off, the only nutrient, I don't know of anything topically that works. I see a lot of stuff advertised. I frankly don't believe it.
Okay.
In terms of what works, alpha lipoic acid. I use 600 milligrams upon arising.
Okay.
The second thing is vitamin B12 in the methyl cobalamin form, not the cyanocobalamin form.
Okay.
The third thing is the fat-soluble version of vitamin B1, which is called benfotiamine. Benfotiamine is B1. Fat-soluble vitamin B1. This combination is the only thing that I've ever seen work. And about a third of the people that have neuropathy, the neuropathy goes away. About a third of the people that have neuropathy, the neuropathy doesn't get any worse. In other words, it doesn't start crawling up his arm. About a third of the people, we can't do anything. You know, I do see results with that particular formula.
The combination.
But I'm frankly really puzzled. Just because your hands get cold all the time, that can be a thyroid problem. That can be a cortisol problem. And it could also be a nerve issue. You know, the reason that I was asking about the zones on the hand is because sometimes if somebody has problems with their neck and they impinge nerves in their neck that are the nerves that go down the arm, they can have zonal numbness in the hand. They can have pain, tingling, alternating numbness and burning, any of those kinds of things. When it isn't really about their hand, it's about their neck.
It could be the neck. I think they've told him that, too.
And so, you know, I'd be interested in mapping exactly where that neuropathy is, because for some people, neuropathy is strictly numbness, and for some people, it's numbness and tingling and burning and alternating, et cetera. So, you know, you can hear my line of questioning is to determine truly whether this is neuropathy exclusively.
Okay. Well, he is 98 years old, so he's doing pretty good other than the neuropathy.
Wow. Okay, Rita. Give Daddy a kiss for me.
All righty. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Rita. Thanks. Wow, 98. Jan writes this. My doctor did a blood test and then prescribed to me estradiol patches. When I got to the pharmacy and read the side effects, it was unbelievable. Blood clots, uterine cancer, heart attack, stroke. I'm running and hiding from this stuff. Your thoughts?
Well, the use of supplemental hormones just during those couple of years right around the menopause can sometimes ease symptoms pretty markedly for women who are having significant symptoms. I'm not a big fan of using hormones forever and ever, amen. I could not comment on just the estradiol alone without knowing what your progesterone level was, what your testosterone level was. They should all be, and your DHEA, they should all be, four of those should be tested at the same time. And also what your complaints are. So sometimes a little dab will do you. Sometimes a little bit of hormone is really beneficial for the bone or really beneficial for the brain. But you've got to have more evidence than just saying, oh, your estradiol is low. Because estradiol, in my opinion, should never be given all by itself to a woman who has a uterus, who is menopausal, without giving her progesterone, which is the oppositional hormone that helps to balance the hormone levels in the body. So again, I don't have quite enough information, Jan, to say exclusively that this is a good or a bad idea.
Well, you're listening to the Health and Nutrition Program on WMNF 88.5 FM. Let's go to Allegra, who's in Fort Worth. Is that right? Allegra, you're in Fort Worth?
Hey there. I'm
or Lake Worth. Lake Park, I bet you're in Lake Worth. Yeah, okay.
I'm of the world. I live on this planet, so wherever you want to place me, but I'm a question for you today is, I'm a massage therapist at Hippocrates over in West Palm Beach, and most of my clients are, they have cancer at certain stages. Now, of course, at Hippocrates, there's like absolutely no sugar. You do not speak it, breathe it, you don't mention it. But a lot of these people, when they come out of this transformational program, this 3-6 week like intensive raw juicing, grass, colonic cleansing, a lot of them kind of are a bit uncertain how they can carry on that routine back at home where their family might eat a lot of meat or be surrounded by sugar. Is there some type of sugar that they can enjoy, like raw local honey or pure grade, the maple syrup from Vermont or something like that, just to kind of sweeten up their life?
Well, first off, this particular center that you're talking about gives people a lot of juices, not just wheatgrass juice, but a lot of juices.
Full-on
and there's
juice.
And again, say it again.
Yes, they're constantly pouring it down. I drink it every day too. So it's,
but the idea is there's sugar in those juices. Naturally occurring sugar in the juices, even in the vegetable juices, even though that's really small. And, if you eat any starch, I had a purple sweet potato as part of my dinner last night, and that starch is going to break down into sugar. So the idea is you're getting sugar anyway. You're talking about concentrated sugar, the, sucrose, white table sugar. There's no difference in terms of the effect on the body of white table sugar than there is of honey or maple syrup or rice syrup or, corn syrup or any of the rest of them. All of them, end up turning into glucose, into C6H12O6. And so, to make honey better than white table sugar because it's got a few minerals in it, well, then you're eating too damn much honey. So the nature of using a sweetener, if you're trying to use a sweetener in something, using a natural fruit like a date or a prune or an apple and using that as a sweetener is another way to stay on, the kind of program that they create at your center.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, I've been to and experienced that dietary selection.
Yeah, and it's, and another question that involves Socrates, they do not allow cashew because cashew, it's in a very, like, indestructible nut. So I guess nature doesn't really want people to be enjoying it. But, I mean, if it's soaked and it's organic and, well, technically raw, because they have to steam it.
Well, anybody who forbids cashews has to forbid mangoes, too, because they're in the same family.
No.
Right.
35 foot.
Right. And plus, you need to know that botanically, cashew isn't even a nut. Botanically, cashew is a fruit. You want to remember, I started in medical botany. So, you know, the nature of looking at these things from the families that they occupy is important. So, yeah, there are a lot of people who react to cashews, and there's a lot of people who don't.
Okay, Allegra, thanks a lot.
Oh, and just one little shout-out. I don't really shout-out, but I just want to wish my mom, Andalita Diaz, who is owner of Villa Frida's and who said WMNF many, many, many years ago, happy 67th birthday, and I love her so very much, and I hope she's listening right now. If she doesn't, then I'll play the recording.
Okay, well, I hope she's listening. That's great. Thanks, Allegra. Let's go to Rick in St. Petersburg. Rick, you're on. What's your question for Eve?
Hi, Rick.
I was listening to your show a couple months ago, and you were talking about a test for headaches with ice behind the neck.
Right.
Can you repeat that?
Yeah, headaches are all vasodilators or vasoconstrictors. Either the blood vessel is spasm shut or else the blood vessel is opened up. If you take ice, you know those horseshoe pillows that you stick in the microwave to heat up? If you take that horseshoe shape, you could take a gallon-sized zip-top bag, put some crushed ice in it, wrap it around your neck. You've only got four arteries that serve your brain. Two on the side, your carotids, and two in the back, your basilar arteries. If you chill those arteries, you're chilling the whole head. You don't have to put the ice where the headache is. So if you put the ice on there, and in 3, 4, 5 minutes, the headache is better, you know it's a vasodilator. And if it's a vasodilator, ice will help, caffeine will help, and salt will help. If you put the ice on and it makes the headache worse, then you know it's a vasoconstrictor. In which case, getting in a hot shower, baking your neck in a hot shower, putting in on one of those pillows that heat up that you put on your neck, drinking a cup of ginger tea, or else having anything that's got hot sauce in it, whether it's cayenne or Tabasco or some kind of chili sauce, those things are all vasodilators. So if you have a vasoconstrictor, you want to dilate it, and if you have a vasodilator, you want to constrict it. Make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Then the question becomes, what caused the vasodilation or what caused the vasoconstriction? But in the meantime, you've given yourself some relief.
I hadn't been able to find this anywhere on the internet described like that.
Nobody does what I do, Rick.
Clearly. Thank you for the information.
Right. Sure. I mean, you know, these kinds of practicum, living in northern Arizona and Colorado for a decade, you know, where I did my medical botany and got to study with the First Nation people. You know, I worked with a population of people that didn't have any money. I mean, it wasn't that they had a little bit of money. They had no money. And so, you know, working with the Hopi and the Navajo and the Hualapai and the Supai and working with people that were just living off the land, I had to learn all kinds of strategies where we didn't have a vitamin to take or an herb to use or a remedy, you know, other than what was in the environment. And so a whole lot of these strategies, these really, as one neurologist who put me down about this headache said, well, that's a low-level intervention. Yeah, buddy, but it worked and your damn drugs didn't.
All right, Rick, thanks a lot.
All right, thank you.
Thanks. David writes this. One thing that surprised me when I got to know some Chinese nationals during my graduate school time at the University of Florida is that they eat very little cheese or dairy products, and I always figured that was partly why they were always so thin and they seemed healthy. Also, my Chinese friends were very surprised by how obese Americans are. They were shocked, actually, and I was thinking that American TV shows and movies don't depict fat people. However, those Chinese guys would smoke cigarettes and drink alcohol like nobody's business, writes David. So David just, I guess, making that statement. And do you want to comment?
Well, I mean, you know, the Chinese don't keep much in the way of farm animals other than pigs and chicken. You know, cows eat a really lot. And so you have to do a lot of providing in order to have a cow that's going to give you milk every day that you're going to turn around and make into cheese. So dairy products are just not a part of the cuisine of all of Southeast Asia. It isn't just China. It's all through, you know, Japan and Southeast Asia, Thailand, et cetera. There's no cheese in their cuisines.
Let's go to Jarvis in Wesley Chapel. Hi, Jarvis. You're on with Eve. What's your question about health and nutrition?
Yes. Hey, thanks for taking my call. And I would like to ask, have you ever heard of African bile mineral balance?
African, what was the rest?
Bile mineral balance.
No, it's the name of a product. I don't know.
No. It's the steps to like a better lifestyle. But anyway, can I spend my second? Are you in front of a computer?
I am.
Could you just go to this website with me? I just want to spend my minute with you with this website, and then I want you to comment on something for me, please.
I'm sorry, but what I have on my computer are the questions that come into us through that computer, and I'll not exit that window.
Okay. I didn't know if you were able to access a website that I wanted you to look at and maybe comment on it for the readers.
Perhaps we can do that at another time, Jarvis.
And Jarvis, is that the website, African Bile Mineral Balance?
No. The name of the website is drsadiescellfood.com.
Dr. Sadie's Cell Food, okay.
Yes, DrSadiesCell.
And so are they selling the product Cell Food on there?
No, it's more of a mythology on better health. And the premise is on anything curing the body has got to come out of the ground. And
mm-hmm.
That's one of the premises on, if you were ever go onto that website, that would explain it more to you.
You're not going to get any argument from me on that point, Jarvis.
Yeah, okay, she agrees with you, Jarvis.
Right, but let me ask you something. You keep saying, I hear you talk about amino acids.
Right.
Could you tell the people out there what the electrical count is in amino acids? Because food, in order for food to be effective in the body, it's got to have an electrical count to it, doesn't it?
I don't know how you're measuring that, Jarvis.
How you would what measure the electricity in the food?
Yeah.
Well, have you ever heard of chemical affinity?
Of course.
Well, then you know that chemical affinity is the body's ability to process electrical foods into energy.
But what's your point in regards to aminos?
Well, amino acids have nothing to do with the body. Because the
body... That's my second good laugh of the day, Jarvis. The majority of your body is made out of protein, and protein is made out of amino acids.
Okay, well, that's what you're saying, but let me say this, and you know, you might get another laugh. Protein and amino acids have absolutely nothing to do with the body. The body's made of minerals. The body's made of 102 minerals. Now, just like you've been educated.
No. There's only 27 minerals that are necessary for the human body. There's over 100 minerals out there, but they're not necessary for the body.
Jarvis, this is really, really, it's a good conversation, but we won't be able to finish it here because we only have about 5 or 6 minutes. Jarvis, thanks a lot. Thanks for suggesting the website.
Right, and remember, amino acids and protein have nothing to do with the body because the body's not made of that.
All right, Jarvis, thanks a lot.
It really is. The body's made of mineral.
All right. Great to hear from you. Mike writes this.
No. I have to interrupt. I can't let information like that go out on the show that I'm responsible for information on. The body is not made out of minerals. The body does contain minerals, and those minerals are critical for function. But the primary ingredient of the body is water. If I squeeze all the water out of the body, then what I've got left is minerals and protein. And proteins are essentially very long chain molecules, and they're made out of what could be hundreds of different amino acids. 8 of them essential, and the other group, what we call non-essential, which is really a misnomer. It just means the body can make them. And so the idea that the body is made out of minerals is, in my opinion, nonsense.
Let's go to our next question. Mike writes, what are good sources of probiotics? That's Mike in St. Pete.
Well, if you're looking in foods for probiotics, then you're looking at things that are fermented. So kefir and yogurt are an example of fermented dairy products, but also you might have sauerkraut or other pickled things like kimchi, and those would be sources of natural probiotics in addition to supplemental probiotics.
Let's go to Susan in Auburndale. Susan, you're on with Eve Prang-Plues. We're talking about health and nutrition.
Good morning, Eve and Rob. How are you today?
Good, Susan.
Good.
You?
I'm doing good. I was wondering if you could recommend, or if you had any input on anything that would be a natural pre-workout supplement or a natural after-workout supplement. What it is whenever I do any kind of exercise in the gym, I have a tendency to feel real achy after that. And I know that they sell non-natural pre-workout supplements and after-workout supplements, but I wondered if you have anything that's natural.
Well, the first thing that I do for somebody that feels achy after they work out is give them 400 IUs of vitamin E every day.
Okay.
Vitamin E can make a big difference. And remember, vitamin E is a complex. If we discovered vitamin E today, we would name the eight different parts, probably E1, E2, E3, but we didn't. We named them alpha, beta, gamma, delta. And so you want the E complex, all eight of those tocopherols and tocotrienols that are in there. The question is, what time of the day are you working out?
Right around 1 o'clock.
And have you had breakfast? And have you had lunch?
Had breakfast, yes, and lunch, no.
Okay, and so you've been. Your breakfast was at what time? 8 a.m.
Pretty much, yeah, right around in that.
Okay, so it's been 5 hours since you ate. The body only wants to go 4 to 5.5 hours without food, so you're ready for fuel.
Okay.
So the nature of having a small amount of fuel, because you want to do that before your workout and follow it with something that contains aminos, something that contains protein, that's one of the ways. If you're trying to bulk up at all, if you're trying to increase your muscle mass, then we want protein following your workout. Dr. Wolf's research indicates that when we get protein in a meal in that 30 to 90 minutes after our workout is done, we actually help to heal the little tiny tears that we make in the muscles as a result of exercise. But prior to the exercise, if you've already been 5 hours without food, then I would suggest that you have a competent snack.
Like a granola bar, something like that.
That's rarely going to be the first thing that I'm going to recommend. It might be celery sticks with peanut butter in it.
So not a high carb. You wouldn't go for the high carb.
No, because you're just going to blast through it. But if I've got a little bit of protein, you know, there's 8 grams of protein and two tablespoons of peanut butter. You know, you put that on some celery sticks. You know, that'll work. And then you've got a little bit of aminos. You've got a little bit of carbs. You've got good water in there. But the achiness, I don't feel, has to do with what you're taking before and after the workout. The achiness is a different story. So, you know, I'd start with the 400 IUs of vitamin E, and then let me know in a month.
How far how soon before the workout would you take the?
Oh, it doesn't make any difference. You could take 7 vitamin E's one day a week. Vitamin E is a fat-soluble vitamin, so it's not that it's going to work instantly. It's just going to raise your total vitamin E count, and that makes a pretty big difference in terms of the achy quality.
I could take that with my breakfast.
You can take that with your breakfast.
Okay, Susan.
Very good.
Susan, thanks
a
lot.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You guys are great.
Thank you. Thanks for saying that. Lots of emails. There's about 8 emails that we haven't read yet. I'm just going to go through them. 813 writes, what about veganism? What are your thoughts?
Oh, well, good that we only have 2 minutes left. First off, there's no vegan cultures in the world. There are no vegan tribes in the world. There are no vegan places in the world. Veganism is a construct. The nature of veganism is what I see is everybody that does it loves it. They become very militant about it. 3 months, 6 months, 1 year later, they do, you know, pretty well. They get a lot of the toxic material out of their body because they're not eating processed foods. And then I begin to see the numbers go down in the tests. I see 43-year-olds with osteoporosis. I see individuals who have deficiency syndromes. So I'm not saying it isn't possible to be healthy as a vegan, but you have to remember, I have a bias because people that come to me in the clinic come to me because they don't feel well. And I find that there is an awful lot of attitude that comes from veganism in terms terms of defending it. I have no question about the fact that we need to treat our animal brothers and sisters a whole lot better, both in terms of raising and in terms of slaughtering these animals. And if you listen to the show on a regular basis, you know I recommend a high plant diet. I've never recommended a high animal diet, but it has been decades in practice of seeing the deterioration of the tissue and of the blood values of individuals who support the vegan diet that is what arouses my concern.
Well, Eve, I'm sorry to say we only have 45 seconds left, a bunch of emails, including a question about why do people grow to be 600 pounds in America, but we won't be able to answer that question this time.
We'll need a whole special show just for that one.
So all you drivers on I-75, be kind to
be
Eve
kind to
as
you.
She drives right south to Sarasota.
Right, in the Black Prius.
Okay,
right.
All right. You can tailgate anybody else, but not Eve.
Thanks, Rob.
All right, Eve, so we'll see you in 2 weeks.
You will.
All right. Stay dry and stay cool. This is WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. We're going to get